This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 157.
When we think about leadership or professional careers, that to get to a next level, we oftentimes need to change our approach, our mindset, our behaviors in particular. And it's thinking about, as I say, those three questions. The first one is, what kind of leader are you now? The good, bad, and the ugly. What kind of leader would you like to be? Ask people to think of words and phrases that you would love people to say about you when you're not in the room, or people that you admire and you want to take on some of those traits. Then the big question is, how do you get there? What needs to change? And that's where self-management comes in. For example, if you are used to behaving in a certain way under certain circumstances, perhaps you want to change that. And that's what self-management is all about.
How can you increase your self-awareness and improve your ability to lead and manage others? Why does emotional intelligence matter more than technical skills for a leader's long-term success? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Since launching the Future of HR podcast in late 2022, I've been fortunate to have meaningful conversations with over 150 HR thought leaders and world-class CHROs from around the globe. These conversations have given me a unique perspective on where HR is today and where we're heading in the future. And because of this vantage point, over the past year, I have had the privilege and opportunity to be a keynote speaker at 16 internal HR conferences for Fortune 500 companies like Kohler, AbbVie, Corning, Nike, LabCorp, and more. And what am I talking about? More often than not, I'm asked to give my signature talk, Future-Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow, which is designed to help your HR team shift their mindset from being a strategic business partner to a value creator. And these aren't just presentations, they're interactive sessions that equip your HR leaders with practical frameworks to challenge conventional thinking and move beyond the traditional HR playbook. If you're planning your next HR conference, career week, or leadership gathering and want to provide your team with insights that drive immediate impact, I'd love to connect and explore how I might help make your event a big success. Feel free to reach out to me at jp@futureofhr.com to start the conversation. And with that, my guest this week is Margaret Andrews. Margaret is a seasoned executive, academic leader, speaker, and instructor. She has created and teaches a variety of leadership courses and professional executive programs at Harvard University. She's the founder of the Milo Center, a private leadership development firm, and her clients include Amazon, Citi, Continental, Walmart, Wayfair, and the United Nations. She's the author of a new book called Manage Yourself to Lead Others, Why Great Leadership Begins with Self-Understanding. Much of the book is based on her Harvard Business course, Managing Yourself and Leading Others, which has been sold out since 2008. This was such a great conversation with Margaret as we discussed why understanding and managing yourself is critical to effectively lead others, why the best leaders help others to grow and glow, the difference between culture takers and culture makers, and what really shapes organizational culture, why managing up is taking responsibility for the partnership with your manager, and how the next level of you concept drives continuous growth throughout your career. I'd love to hear your thoughts as you listen to this episode, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Margaret. Margaret, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
Thank you. Very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you talk about your book, your career, what you've been doing in this space of managing yourself to lead others, which is so critical. But as I was reading the book, I have to start here because you talk about a boss telling you early in your career that you weren't self-aware. And I just wonder, like, what went through your mind when that happened? And how did that change your career? How did you respond to that feedback?
What happened was that I had been with an organization for several years and had a new boss. And I would say we didn't always see eye to eye. At one point in a meeting, he turns to me and says, "You're not self-aware." And it was not said in a kind and developmental manner. As I heard that, I was confused a little bit because I'd had a pretty good career up to that point and in that organization. And I was also very defensive thinking about that. In fact, I would say there were just so many thoughts and feelings going through my head at that time that I had a hard time saying anything. It was like a brain jam. But then he went on to tell me that I was overly ambitious and demanding, and I didn't understand how my behaviors impacted other people. And later, I will say, when I calmed down, I actually could hear what was being said and realize, you know, there's some truth in this. I had very good strategic and operational skills, but I could be demanding and I could be impatient. And so it made some people on my team feel a bit anxious or underappreciated. And certainly my relationship with my boss was underperforming. That's when I thought, this is mine. I own this. And as much as I did not like the situation that I had created, I realized it was a situation of my own creating and that I didn't want this. So I set off to say, I want to change this. And that's what got me going on this. So the class that I teach is an outcome of that. My current self is an outcome of that. The book is an outcome of that. It was definitely a turning point for me.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think we've all gotten feedback that's kind of feels like a punch in the face, kind of thing, like, wow, okay, really? I'm coming off that way. But I think what's great is you really took it to heart afterwards, like you said, took a minute to then actually absorb it, but then start to say, well, I don't want to be that way. So I can actually change that. I actually can control how I'm coming across, be more thoughtful about how I'm leading the team, how I'm responding. And I think that is really the key of leadership. It's hard to do this. It's actually, in some ways, they did you a favor by giving you that feedback, even if it was sort of tough to hear in the moment, right?
Absolutely. Feedback is a gift. And we just have to remember that some gifts come in ugly packages. It doesn't mean that the gift itself is not valuable, but you said it took a minute to take that in. It took me longer than a minute, but it ultimately did sink in. That's what changes things. So as awful as that situation felt at the time, it really was a good thing.
Yeah, and it seems like it set you on a great course. And before the book, which I know everyone will hopefully go out and check out or buy, you create a course called Manage Yourself to Lead Others at Harvard, which has had a wait list for over a decade, which is pretty impressive. Can you walk us through what is Manage Yourself to Lead Others? What's it mean in practice? When someone says manage yourself to lead others, like what's that really look like?
Right. Yeah. So explain yourself. So the course at Harvard, and it's also an executive program at the Harvard Professional and Executive Development Programs, is called Managing Yourself to Lead Others. So that's the title of the course. The book is slightly different. The idea is that managing yourself comes before leading others. And that is that you have to, first of all, you have to understand yourself. If you don't understand yourself, you can't manage something that you don't understand. And I can go a little bit deeper into that in a moment if you'd like. Understand yourself, manage yourself, because also, if you don't understand yourself, you really can't understand other people very well. And if you can't manage yourself, you have no credibility asking anyone else to evolve or to grow or to change the way they do things. So that's the underlying part of it. So the arc of the course, we spend a lot of time talking about how do you understand yourself? And I use several questions of what kind of leader are you now? What kind of leader do you want to be? What's that delta? But also a lot of time we spend on understanding yourself and what's your history? What's your background? Who and whose thinking have influenced you throughout your life? And of course, these are things like parents and early caregivers, family, could be religion, community, friends, friends' parents, could be movies you saw, books you read, right? It's a big question, this one. Also about your values and about what feedback you've received over your life in your personal and professional life. Because quite often, they're more similar than we think. So many people say, oh, I'm so different at home and at work. But very often, if we look at the feedback, it's pretty similar.
Interesting. So obviously, I think people always love the journey of self-exploration because it's our favorite topic. We are inherently going to be narcissistic and thinking about ourselves, that is just our lens, right? It's very hard to get out of that. But what I'm hearing you say, the starting point here is really doing a deep dive on your background, your values. How did you get here? Challenging assumptions that we don't do very often because it can be uncomfortable. What patterns do I have? Some of that can get into people's personal lives and family lives, which some people don't always want to have those conversations, right? We'd like to kind of maybe leave that where that's at. And how much of that do you guys get into where it's not psychotherapy or even therapists? Because some people might feel that way. I guess, what's the line you guys are drawing as you're going through that self-reflection piece?
A couple of things. What I always tell people is these questions are for them. I'm not going to ask them to share the answers, but they can share insights if they want to. But in pretty much any class that I teach, I always say, share what you want to share and don't share what you don't want to share. But the other is that I tell people a great quote by C.S. Lewis that I think is so applicable here. He's a former British novelist. And his quote is, you can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending. And I think that one spoke to me because I thought, yeah, we all have a path. And things we're proud of, and probably some things we're not so proud of. But we can decide. We get to decide where we go next.
Yeah, that's a really great quote. And let's talk a little bit more about, because I think you're talking a lot about self-understanding, which makes sense. And then a lot of people would say, what's self-awareness? Are these the same thing? Are they different? I think you're making an important distinction, but talk about what that looks like in the course and the book.
Self-awareness, and of course, you know, there's so many different words to explain the same thing and similar things. So I don't get too deeply into that or offended if somebody gets it wrong. To me, self-awareness oftentimes relates to what we think of in emotional intelligence. Are you aware of the emotion that you're having right now? The flip side of that, do you know how you behave under some of these emotions? I always ask people, who knows that you're mad first? You or the person you're with, right? Because if it's you, that points to self-awareness. If it's the other person, that points to not having much self-awareness. So generally, it's about, do you understand the emotion that you're having and how you come across to others in those emotional states? To me, self-understanding is a little bit more. It's going a little bit deeper into it. It's understanding the people, the ideas, the events and situations that have influenced you throughout your life, the feedback, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's a really helpful distinction. I love that quote or that question of who knows you're mad first is a great one. Can make us all pause a little bit and think, especially our family members that are close to us. They know sometimes before we know.
Yeah. Or sometimes we know, but we can't quite manage it very well. They oftentimes are the ones that are on the receiving end of that.
One thing you talk about too in the book that I think is really important is this idea of next level of you. Tell us more about what this means and how do we start the journey to get there?
The next level of you, I talk about how at each level of our career, and quite frankly, in our life, takes a different level of us. So, you know, you're different. You were different at 18 than you were at 8, 28 than you were at 18. You're different now than you were probably 5 years ago. All of us are different than we were pre-COVID. And that's part of life, and that's part of growth. When we think about leadership or professional careers, that to get to a next level, we oftentimes need to change our approach, our mindset, our behaviors in particular. And it's thinking about, as I say, those three questions. The first one is, what kind of leader are you now? The good, bad, and the ugly. What kind of leader would you like to be? I ask people, think of words and phrases that you would love people to say about you when you're not in the room, or people that you admire and you want to take on some of those traits. Then the big question is, how do you get there? What needs to change? And that's where self-management comes in. For example, if you are used to behaving in a certain way under certain circumstances, perhaps you want to change that. And that's what self-management is all about. And so I talk about in the book, it was helpful for me, and I think it's been helpful for a lot of people that have been in my programs, is the idea of how we evolve. It is not linear, and it looks a little bit more like an S-curve, you know, where you start off, and in the beginning, you are not good at all. You're trying to figure this thing out. What does it look like? Who's good at it? Who could I pattern myself after? Who could I ask? All of these kinds of things. And then there's these little baby steps and lots of missteps, lots and lots of mistakes as you're learning something. You say, for example, sometimes people say, I want to stop swearing. I'll just use that as a symbol. simple example. Well, it's hard if you try to do that. And so you're going to make a lot of missteps on your way to doing it. Now, think of other things where you want to listen more or stop interrupting or give people more autonomy and stop micromanaging. Those are even harder. The idea is, again, is you start off, you're not good at all. You learn a little bit about it. You make a lot of baby steps, a lot of missteps. And then suddenly you kind of get better slowly, then quickly. And then you level off. It looks more like an S curve. And at that point, so you're evolving, right? You're leveling up. But at that point, you have to start a new S curve. Okay, you've mastered that one or gotten better at it, and now you need to do something different. But the hard part, and this is where the really hard part comes, is that when you launch a new S curve, you're and learning a new behavior, your performance actually usually goes down before it goes back up again, right? Because you're back at the bottom of not being good at this. And the problem is that a lot of people quit at that point. They say, oh, this is not who I am. This does not feel authentic. This is not what got me to where I am. And the point is, right, this is what got you here, but what's going to get you to the next level is something a little bit different. That's where people have to be willing to make those missteps, to make those public mistakes. And that's hard. And it gets harder in many respects as you get more senior because more people see you fall.
Yeah, I think that's a really great concept of the next level of you because I think we talk a lot about being your best or bring your best self to work, which is kind of flatlining. It doesn't mean you're growing and moving up. And the message, which is inspirational, the next level of you is how do I continuously improve? How to reinvent myself? I don't think about this a lot. My listeners will be like, what are you talking about? But if you think about like a Madonna or somebody, these pop stars and celebrities or even actors who've recreated their careers, and they're good examples because we all see them publicly. So we have like a shared point of view on them. And I'm not sure to say Madonna is the right one here, but she's had reinventions. Other celebrities have had reinventions where I think they figure out what's the next level for them. How are they going to morph, adapt, and grow? And maybe they were good, maybe they were bad. I don't know, but it's a good model of like, hey, what am I going to be in my 40s? What am I going to be in my 50s? What am I going to be in my 60s? What is that new version of yourself? So I think it's an inspirational point of view to think that through. I would take that one just away from the whole entire conversation. Like that to me is the whole game. How do you always think about what's the next level of you? And if you're working towards that and you're not afraid to fail a little bit, I can't see anybody but having a lot of success to your point of pushing through.
Actually, I think your use of a lot of musicians and bands in that way is a great one because we can all remember some band that we liked and then their next album comes out, we're all anticipating it and then half of us go, ew, this isn't, oh, but we're not used to it yet. Then we get to grow with them. I actually think it is a really good example.
Yeah, those poor bands that have to play for 30 years the same songs over and over again can be kind of rough. I think they're probably tired of playing some of those songs. They want to come up with something new.
Yes. How many times can you play Satisfaction? Apparently a lot. Yes.
Yeah, a lot. Make a lot of money doing that too, apparently. But
yes.
But the other thing you talk about, we talk about leadership styles. Obviously, your book and what you do is around managing yourself and to lead others. And I think sometimes people want a blueprint for like, what is the best leadership style? And Margaret, from your experience, you said that there isn't one, which I'd agree with, but how do you help people discover what is the best way to lead for them that's authentic?
Yeah, I use an exercise that I think has worked very well for people to really get this and internalize it. So what I do is I ask people to think about the best boss they've ever had. It has to be somebody that they work directly for. So it cannot be a celebrity CEO. It cannot be a fictional character, you know, so I say no Ted Lassos. But they will think about the best boss and they say, okay, now write down a list of all the reasons why this person was your best boss. All of them, the big ones, the small ones, the ones you think are funny, the ones you think no one would agree with, whatever. And I say, go for a long list. It's a long list. If it's a big one, they were a great leader. You got to break that down. That means lots of different things. So anyway, I give them some time to think about that. And I give them all kinds of examples of reasons why somebody might be your best boss. Then I say, okay, now look at your long list and circle or highlight the top three, which takes a minute because, wow, you have this long list. Now you got to, wow, what were the three most strategic or were the most that really made them, that made the difference? Then I say, okay, you got three Post-it notes. Put one of those reasons on each one of them and put them on the right board. And the boards are IQ. So basically meaning they were just super smart. The second board is around technical and functional skills, also known as hard skills. And then the third board is around interpersonal skills, which goes by lots of names, soft skills, relationship skills, emotional intelligence, etc. So then they get up and they move. And what they first, when they first get it, is when there's a traffic jam at that third board, right? Everybody is going there. And some people have all three of their notes on that board. They realize, oh, that's what made the difference. It wasn't that they were the smartest. It wasn't that they were the best coder or data scientist or surgeon or whatever. It was that they cared about me, that they helped me develop, et cetera. In fact, one of my favorite ones that was on a post-it note was said, this person helped me grow and glow. And I thought, yeah, I see what they mean. That was the thing that really get people. And I asked him, was that person perfect? Everyone, no. Do you think that that person kind of understood themselves and managed themselves well? And they said, yeah. I said, do you think they understand and care and led you well? And yes. And then I say, would you work for them again? And I see a sea of people nodding yes. So that's when I think people get it, that it's not necessarily these celebrities that we hold up as being this great leader, that we know what it looks like. And it's actually attainable.
What a great exercise to really help people come to the conclusion, but kind of almost in a data-driven way around the fact that the soft skills, people caring about you, caring your advancement, helping you to grow and glow is the factor that makes the difference. That's the X factor in these really in relationships. It's not that they helped you figure out how to build better spreadsheets or do better financial analysis or in HR's case, recruit better or build a better talent strategy. It's that you learn from them because you feel like they cared. And I think that's really good. That's a great exercise. How do you encourage people to say, well, like everyone might lead differently because some people might connect differently and there's not just one way to connect. Is there any differences that come out in the course around that?
Yeah. So I oftentimes will put up a slide that has 10 leaders, J. Robert Oppenheimer, Oprah, Elon Musk. I can't remember who's all on there. I switch them in and out all the time. And then I ask people, I say, so what do all these people have in common? And there's just complete silence in the room. And I say, okay, we could probably assume that we would all call them all leaders and that they're probably a little higher than average in intelligence. But I said, other than that, what do they have in common? Again, crickets. And I say, exactly. Right? That's the whole point, is not much. That some of them are known to be more empathetic, some more hard-nosed, they're all over the place. Some of them are in business and finance, some are in government service, etc. So basically, it takes all types. And also, the list that I put up always has people that came from wealth and those who didn't. Also, people that dealt with addiction and or abuse or depression and these kinds of things. So the point being is that there's not a single type. There's not a single background. There's not a single way. It just kind of gives people a little bit of ease thinking, oh, so the whole point is lean into yourself. Lean into what you care about, what you're good at. I think so many times people want to shore up their weaknesses. And I'm not saying that's a bad idea, but oftentimes is planting ourselves where we will grow, doing something that we care about, intrinsic motivation, those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's really good. Well played on all the different leaders and kind of what they have in common. And I think to your point on the strengths-based movement, that is nice. We all have strengths. They're easier to lean into. In my experience, to get to the next level of you, you have to then figure out where you have real weaknesses that need to now become at least not weaknesses and at least neutral. And where can you leverage your strengths to maybe go to that next level? But you can't ignore areas you have to get better at because otherwise you have a deficit and it will hurt you in the next level, right? Especially when you go into executive levels and things like that, that is just really important. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't know what you really are great at and what your strengths are and what hopefully makes you you and what makes you different. And I think that you should leverage. So I think it's a dual message. For me, it's personally, I always want people to know that because I think it's nuanced. And sometimes we hear the strengths, just lean into that. And I'm like, that sounds easy. That's like me doing 7 pushups a day and thinking I'm going to be in good shape after a month. Like, that's not going to happen, right?
I'm glad you said that you used the word nuanced. I think so much of this, what we're talking about, is nuanced. That people want, very oftentimes, the right answer or how should I be, or how should I approach the solve problem or solve it or something? And the answer is, well, it depends, right? It depends on so many different factors. And it is nuanced. And that's why it's so important that you understand yourself and you understand the context. Because the right answer on Monday may not be the right answer on Tuesday because things have changed.
Yeah. I love the message, though, is it's liberating in a lot of ways, because what you're saying is you need to figure out what your next level of you is, who you are as a leader and a person, but there's not one mold you have to fit into, which I think is really important that you can be yourself in that way. Show up as a leader. And I think leaders show up in a very certain way. So we can kind of talk more about that. But everyone has a style of leadership that's still professional, that's still going to be, again, bringing your best self. Doesn't mean bring yourself from home. That authentic self that no one really wants to be around. That's another conversation, another podcast. But I think this is around being your style, right? You can be, and there's lots of different leaders to your point. Some are more direct, some are more caring, some are more aloof, et cetera. Now, you did talk about in the book, another concept I thought was interesting and that I thought HR leaders really should know about is this idea of being a culture taker versus a culture maker. Break that down for us a little more, and how can leaders become more aware of which one they are?
Yeah. The idea is culture takers and culture makers, that the vast majority of people in an organization, when I talk about culture, just to be very clear, I'm usually talking about larger organizations as opposed to startups, et cetera. Most organizations that we would join, we are culture takers, meaning that we are joining a culture and we will be expected to fit into that culture, maybe changing the way we approach things, et cetera. Culture makers are people that have the ability to make the culture, which are usually founders of a company, but also people that come in at really pivotal times. So if a company is really experiencing a lot of difficulty, the person who takes over during that time is going to have an outsized impact on that. So think Satya Nadella at Microsoft when he took over, right? They were not doing well. So the difference is really that a culture taker, one time I explained this and somebody summed it up and they said, oh, I get it. That means that you could be in a position to be a culture maker, but they're just lazy. And I said, oh gosh, no, that's not what I mean at all. The thing about a culture taker is that they have access to all the levers that you would need to pull to truly change a culture. This is, who do you hire? Where do you hire from? Who do you promote? What's the criteria? What kind of training and development do you have? What are the systems? How do you reward people? Can you align the incentives? If you say that you want a more collaborative culture, do you reward people that are being collaborative? Or is the next person that you promote the really sharp-elbowed person? Because that's what people will pay attention to. So the person that is the true culture maker is the CEO. That's the person that has the true power to change it. Not on their own. They need a lot of help. But if they are not completely bought in and behind this and championing it all the way through, it won't happen.
Very clear. Very interesting to hear that perspective, and I think helpful for HR leaders. Now, Margaret, you also define, switching topics a little bit here, you define managing up. And I think this definition is just brilliant because a lot of people struggle with this idea of managing up, like it's politics, it's kissing up, etc. You say managing up is taking responsibility for the relationship with your manager. And tell us more about why you say this and how a deeper self-understanding can help us approach those relationships in a much better or different way.
The way I think about it, and there's a great story in the book too about somebody who has a very similar thought on this to me, is that you think of this person as a partner. That with a partner, you are open with them, you will tell them what you think, and you don't want to let them fail. So you will sometimes tell them unpleasant things that they may not want to hear, but is really important for them to hear. So I think that we've all had bosses that perhaps were not our best, or maybe we just didn't have a good fit with them. But I've always thought that the way of thinking of them as a partner has been helpful. Because yes, do we work for them? Yes, we also work with them. And in truth, our success and their success are tied. We do want to be a partner to that person and tell them what they need to know. And it depends on how we do it. So you are a different person than I am versus somebody else. Some people like it very direct. Some people like indirect. So we have to get to know them. And this, again, goes back to understanding yourself. It can be understanding what type of boss, if I'm interviewing for a new job, is this person, are we going to be able to be good partners? And it may make you want to take one job versus another. So yeah, I think it's understanding ourselves, what we need, and also understanding the other person and how do they roll and how can we make this fit? You don't have to be like them, but you need to be able to complement them.
Yeah, I think it's great advice, because even though in the ideal world, we'd have leaders and managers that adapt their style to the team to make sure they fit and to build motivation and all that, many bosses will not do that. It's a failing strategy to think that your boss will conform and change to your style. It's the other way around. So I think the idea of taking that responsibility to figure out how to make that partnership happen is critical. And to your point of knowing yourself is really a good point too, because a lot of times I talked to folks, they've taken jobs. They knew that wasn't going to be a great situation or a great boss, but they wanted the resume, they wanted the brand of the resume. They take these jobs and they kind of say, I don't know if that was the right fit, but I did it, right? So I think that's really important to have those two things in mind as you take and look at jobs. I'm also curious, because you do a lot of developing of leaders. If you had a magic wand or you could change one thing about how organizations are developing leaders today, what would you do differently, or what would it be?
I would focus a lot more on helping people understand themselves and also understanding the organizational culture and how this all fits. I think many, many people want to be part of something bigger than themselves. Therefore, understanding the context of what they're doing and how their work fits in and why it's important is really helpful. And that's not that hard to do. The other thing, I've also had somebody ask me that question where they said, well, I'm not sure I want people to really understand themselves, because what if they realize that they're not a good fit for this organization? And I just didn't say anything for a second. And I said, well, that sounds like it would be a good thing, right? It would be a good thing for everyone, because the people that are going to do best in any firm are people that are a good fit and also are intrinsically motivated by what they're doing.
Right, for sure. Now, if an HR leader is listening to our conversation and thinks, I want to become a better leader, that leader that I envision, what's one of the very first steps you think they should take?
One of the things is that I would get to know all of the business and all of the context, because there is no department in business, right? It's not a marketing problem. It's not a sales problem. It's not an HR problem. It's a business problem, and they're all integrated. And what's going on with our competitors and the regulatory environment and all of those things. So you can't isolate marketing from a regulation change. You also can't isolate HR from a regulation change. So I think it's understanding, and I say this, and it's not just HR, I think all finance people should understand marketing or sales, right? It's that we make better decisions when we understand how we're all interconnected.
Now, Lloyd, I didn't prep you, but we talk a lot about that in this podcast, because business acumen is so critical. It is the foundation for being a successful HR leader. You have to understand the business. But I think that your point on context is really good. And it's good to hear you say also the other functions need to know other functions as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Don't leave marketing to the marketing folks, and don't, right? That kind of thing. And I'm not dissing marketing folks. I'm just saying that we all need to understand this. Just because you're not a marketing expert doesn't mean that you don't have something that would be helpful for them to know. You have a different perspective, and that's helpful.
Margaret, last question for you. I ask all my guests this question. It's, what is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Crucial. Because I think it's always been crucial, but not everyone knew that. Perhaps we're coming around to that a lot of times we think, oh, strategy and finance and things like those are much, much sexier. And I think, wow, but none of this works if you don't have the right people in the right seats and developing them. So crucial, it would be what I would say. And I just hope that everybody else gets that memo too. But people that are in it should wear the badge proudly.
Absolutely. Crucial. It makes a lot for us, and it means a lot for HR leaders. Margaret, the book is Manage Yourself to Lead Others. People need to go out and buy it. Thank you so much for taking time to share your story and insights from the book and your career.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Margaret for sharing her insights and practical advice for her new book, Manage Yourself to Lead Others.
As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. Go to futureofhr.com and subscribe, and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus HR thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with another amazing guest, Scott Anthony. Scott is a clinical professor of strategy at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, where his research and teaching focuses on adaptive challenges of disruptive change. Scott's going to be joining us to discuss his ninth book, Epic Disruptions, 11 Innovations That Have Shaped Our Modern World. This is an incredible book, and it was an incredible conversation and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for being part of our Future of HR community.